Catholic Conversations with Jason Bramley on Catholic Spirit Radio 89.5 and 92.5. Brought to you by the generous support of Meyer Bramley Insurance, serving Illinois, Missouri, and Kansas. Meyer Bramley Insurance can be reached online at mbi.agency or via phone at 844-890-2626. Catholic Conversations, where we talk about faith, family, and finance.
We are back, Catholic Conversations with Jason Bramley on Catholic Spirit Radio 89.5. We have a fantastic guest lined up with us today. John Gravino is with us on doing an interview over the phone, so we hope you enjoy it. If you missed his conversation with Patrick Coffin that we aired a few weeks ago, go back and listen to it. I know it's on YouTube. It was a great conversation. I wanted John to come on and speak to us a little bit more about it. So, John, thank you so much for coming back on the radio with us specifically.
Oh, thank you, Jason. Thanks for having me on your show.
Absolutely. So you are a Catholic author. Is that correct?
Yes.
Is that that's your day job, right?
Somewhat. It's partly my day job. I really do it on a part-time basis. But I published my first book 4 years ago. And from there, things kind of expanded because I had to promote the book, of course. So I ended up starting a website to do that. And then I also found my way onto social media for the same reasons. I hadn't been on social media prior to that. So I've only been on social media and doing that kind of stuff for the past 4 years.
Gotcha. So it's just like running any other small business, right? It's all the ancillary things that you never probably really think about when it comes to...
That's exactly right. You spend all this time invested in research and so forth and writing your book, and then you forget afterwards, you forget there's a whole other dimension to this, which is trying to get people to read it, right? Trying to get their message out.
At least if you want to sell some copies, there is, right?
That's right. And you're trying to, you know, as Catholics, we're trying to spread an important message, Christ's message, and so that's, of course, the most important part. So we want to get the word out, so to speak, and that takes a lot of that's a lot of work.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
That's why we're so passionate here about Catholic Radio. We think, you know, it's just another platform that gives us the ability to hopefully evangelize to folks who either are Catholic or are not Catholic, and bring them closer to Christ through the platform that we've been given.
That's wonderful. That's a great apostolate, the Catholic Radio movement.
That's probably a good place, too, to plug that we have to have sponsors and donors to stay on the air. So if you like this show and all the other shows on Catholic Spirit Radio, don't forget to support the radio station. I'll give the other John a plug for the radio station while we're at it. What is, give us a little background on yourself if you could. Are you a cradle Catholic? Are you a convert?
No, I'm a cradle Catholic. And, I've been Catholic my whole life, but that doesn't mean that I was always a, you know, on fire, completely devoted Catholic. I would say I was very lukewarm, as a youngster. I was culturally Catholic. My parents were very good about getting us to church every Sunday and on holy days of obligation, and they made sure that we had our sacraments. So we were observant Catholics growing up. So,
yeah, that still puts you in like the top 10 or 15% of Catholics, I think.
Right. My parents really did a great job, I think. I aspire to, you know, the example that they set for me with my own kids. But so I was a cradle Catholic, but there was definitely a falling away in college and a questioning period where I wasn't so set on my Catholic beliefs. I majored in philosophy in college, and I have to say probably most of my professors were atheists. I didn't go to a Catholic college, so the kind of philosophy I was schooled in was definitely from an agnostic perspective, to say the least. But the thing is, to come back around, after I graduated from college, I nevertheless had a reconversion experience. And that got me back, that got me interested in my faith, and the philosophy background that I had also got me interested in a lot of Catholic thinkers, because philosophy is very important to Catholic thought. So even though my philosophical background was sort of from an agnostic perspective, nevertheless, I think it did prepare me for my reconversion experience, because it got me interested in Catholic writers. I was familiar with a lot of the arguments that Catholic writers were writing about, because I had been introduced to them in college. And so that's what got my first book going, was my first book was An Answer to the New Atheist. And so I thought, and if you're familiar with them, Sam Harris is one of the prominent American new atheists who also had a philosophy background. And his arguments are philosophical in nature. So I felt very at home tackling his arguments. And so that's kind of what brought me into writing. So in other words, so philosophy, even though it was very secular and worldly, what I studied, it ended up serving my Catholic reconversion very well.
Well, God does a fantastic job at planting those seeds sometimes when we don't realize it and least expect it.
That's right. Yes, that's very true.
You know, you bring up an interesting a thought that I have for you, and that is in regards to atheism. We've had some other authors on previously when we talked about atheists, and I had made the comment. So, located here in Central Illinois, I don't really know that many atheists or people who even kind of claim to be atheists. But the thought that I had when you were talking about it is that, you know, there's a lot of Christians that, you know, it seems like recently on social media, especially, there's kind of been this argument over hell and whether or not hell exists and do people really go to hell? And so I almost kind of wonder, is that not somewhat of a form of atheism? I mean, I guess I look at it from the perspective of, if you don't believe in hell or you don't believe that hell exists, then do you really believe in God, and do you really believe in heaven?
Right. Well, do you really believe in the Gospels? Do you believe in the word of Jesus Christ? Because Jesus certainly preached it. There's no getting around it. So did the apostles. So
yeah, it was one of Jesus' most common topics, I think, was hell.
Yes, absolutely. Yes, I do think that I wouldn't call it atheism necessarily. But, you know, it's definitely a species of heterodoxy. It's definitely, you know, you're definitely moving away from orthodox traditional Catholic belief if you're going to entertain those ideas. Now, there are people. Now, the thing is, I think, you know, there really isn't any room for argument on the question of hell's existence. But one question that is open is how many people are in hell? Nobody really knows the answer to that question. We know, really, Jesus actually taught us that we don't know the answer to that question because we aren't capable of judging. So, you know, so some people do speculate, you know, is hell full or is it actually pretty empty there? Well, I think actually we don't have the answer to that question. However, in the Sermon on the Mount, Jesus does speak about the way leading to salvation as being the narrow and difficult way, and very few, right? He speaks about very few finding that way, and the road being very wide that leads in the other direction. So, you know, there are places where Jesus seems to imply that it is pretty easy to lose your salvation. It's hard. I think it's difficult to make the case that nobody's in hell based on the words of Christ.
Yeah, absolutely. And you know, saints throughout the ages and you know, everything else. I mean, we've had a pretty long run at thinking that hell is at least not vacant of anyone, and more than likely, to your point, potentially quite full.
Jesus actually comes pretty close to suggesting that Judas actually went to hell. I mean, you can't say absolutely that he said that, but he didn't say, Judas, you're going to hell, but he did say better for him never to have been born.
Right. Absolutely.
Those are pretty, those are pretty hard. That's a pretty harsh condemnation.
So from the church's perspective, obviously we have a process by which we canonize saints, and we determine that this person is in fact in heaven. And Jesus said that those things that we bind on earth, that, you know, will be bound in heaven. If the church wanted to, would they be able to have a process by which they determined that someone was in fact in hell?
No, I'm sure that that can't be done because there's no way nobody knows the state of a person's soul at their death, right?
Gotcha.
I mean, I've heard people say, you know, a guy could be a murderer walking up to the scaffold, right?
Sure.
Who knows, you know, in those final moments before the axe falls.
Absolutely.
A man could repent.
Absolutely.
And not only that, but think of the good thief on the cross. He was condemned. He was a condemned criminal in his last dying moments. And Jesus said, "This day you will be with me in paradise." So,
right.
So we even have textual confirmation that people who seem to merit hell, might be saved at the last moment if their heart is repented. Now, then there's the problem with the other thief, right?
Right.
Who did not
repent.
Right. There's no suggestion that he repented, right? So, but we don't, but of course, the church doesn't say anything about him. We don't judge that.
Right.
So,
we leave that up to the big man.
There will never be a process by which the church judges, says, "Oh,
right,
these people are in hell." No, that'll never happen.
So getting into the book, you said you had written a few books. Your most recent book, what's it titled, and kind of what was the history in getting you to write that book?
Yeah, so I've written two books, and the second one, the most recent one that came out this summer, is called Confronting the Pope of Suspicion. And so the origin of that book was, so I had been writing some articles for a website called The Stream, and they had asked me at the end of 2018 to interview a very interesting priest by the name of Dr. Paul Solondz. And Dr. Paul Solondz did a study on the sexual abuse crisis that was published at the end of 2018. And so the Stream asked me to interview him about his study. And what his study showed was that what he was doing was studying the spread of sexual abuse in the United States. And he was trying to find, can you find any other possibly causal factors that played into this? And what he found was that the spread of the sexual abuse crisis tracked very closely with the rise of gay subcultures in seminaries. That's what he found, a very, very close correlation there between them, suggesting that there was a causal link. And so so what did Dr. Solondz mean about a gay subculture? By that, what he meant was there were seminaries in the United States and elsewhere that had in their seminaries an active gay culture going on, and that in many of these cases, this gay subculture was actively encouraged by people in leadership positions in the seminary. So in other words, the seminary was in some way officially recognizing or not condemning this kind of behavior. They were in some way approving it, which was shocking to me. I was completely stunned by the revelation that seminaries were actually okay with homosexuality, which is obviously, by the teachings of the church, a mortal sin.
Right.
So I wanted to, after interviewing Dr. Solondz, what I wanted to do is I wanted to find out, where on earth were these gay subcultures coming from? How did seminaries ever get the crazy idea that mortal sin is okay?
Sure.
Obviously, the conclusion is that these seminaries must have drawn the conclusion that homosexuality was not sinful. That had to be what was going on here. They weren't they couldn't have been approving of mortal sin. They couldn't have been saying mortal sin's okay. So they must have been saying that homosexuality is not sinful any longer. And that's exactly what I found to be the case, that many seminaries were using theology textbooks that had rejected traditional sexual morality from the Bible. They had rejected it completely and were following now, instead of following the church's teaching traditions on sexual morality, instead they were relying on social science.
So
because Masters and Johnson says that homosexuality is a natural variant of the human sexual instinct, therefore it must be natural and there mustn't be anything wrong with it, and so therefore we shouldn't condemn it. That's what some theology textbooks were teaching in the 1970s. And so some seminaries were following that, and so they weren't discouraging priests from practicing homosexuality.
So this wasn't a situation where the seminary administration said, hey, we don't have enough seminarians, so let's go ahead and, you know, accept some guys that might have some moral concerns for us. You know, we need as many priests as we can get. This was brought on through the curriculum, basically, to to open the minds and unfortunately damage the hearts of men. And I know you also talk about not just seminaries, but, you know, convent type situations with nuns and whole
That's
orders
right.
of sisters.
That's right. And exactly. That it wasn't the case that people were saying, well, we're desperate for priests, so therefore we've got to allow these, you know, people who aren't really qualified in. That's not what happened. In fact, at the time that all of this was going on, the seminaries were full. The church started out with lots, they had lots of vocation. It was after the sexual revolution entered into the church that you see the drop off in a seminary recruitment. Because what happened, because now that seminaries were abandoning scripture and instead following social science was saying that it is harmful for you to deny your sexual instinct. It's harmful you. So homosexuals need to practice their homosexuality, but not only that, heterosexuals need to be practicing their sexuality also. And one of the worst things, according to these social scientists, like people like Sigmund Freud, right?
Mm-hmm.
These people were saying denying your sexual instincts is the worst thing that you can do. So this really cast a shadow over the practice of celibacy. So not only was homosexuality being approved of in these seminaries, but celibacy was being frowned upon, because they were buying this psychological argument that denying your sexual instinct was harmful. And so what happened was, if it's true that I've got to follow my sexual instincts and celibacy is bad, think about the impact that's going to have on a heterosexual priest. A heterosexual priest is going to say, well, if I need to be sexually active in order to be psychologically healthy, then the obvious answer is to get married. So either they're going to allow married priests, which they didn't do, or I have to leave the priesthood and go ahead and get married. So that's actually what happened. One of the reasons why we lost so many priests was because many, many heterosexual priests had concluded that celibacy was psychologically harmful, and so that they needed to do the natural, quote-unquote, natural and healthy thing and go get married. A researcher by the name of Donald Cousins wrote a book about this. And in that book, and it's quoted a lot in the literature, he estimated that at this time, 20,000 priests left the priesthood, and he speculates that a lot of them were basically heterosexual priests who left to get married.
Wow.
So, and if you're familiar, you may or may not be familiar with one priest in particular by the name of Richard Sipe.
Not familiar.
He actually was the priest. If you saw the movie Spotlight, which was the Hollywood movie about the Catholic sexual abuse scandal, the movie was based on his writings and his theories about it. And he was a former Catholic priest that left the priesthood to get married. So he was one of these guys that bought into the whole sexual revolution that said that celibacy was bad, and what we all have to do is not deny our sexual identities and, you know, live a quote-unquote more fulfilling life. That's what was going on. And I mention him because he is because he's had a huge impact on our understanding of the abuse scandal. He blames celibacy, Richard Sipe does. But in fact, what Dr. Solon found out with his research was that it was just the opposite. At the time, the abuse scandal spread and increased, not when priests were being encouraged to practice celibacy. The abuse scandal increased when celibacy was being discouraged, right? So the abuse scandal is actually associated with the disappearance of celibacy, not with celibacy itself. As priests became less celibate, the sexual abuse scandal became more widespread.
Gotcha. I know, you know, it seemed like the sexual abuse issue is obviously the biggest, you know, the biggest issue that we have currently. But I think to your point, there's almost another the underlying current, by and large, also is that for basically 1900 years or you know, through the first greatest percentage of the church history, there was not only a beauty, but a benefit sacrificially to deny one's body, you know, whether that be, you know, through, you know, celibacy or through, you know, fasting, those types
That's
of
right.
things, to deny the body, to lift up the spirit. And so, you know, the sexuality part is the biggest problem, but I think by and large, it's kind of a subconscious idea throughout the vast majority of the church that we really shouldn't be denying ourselves of anything at this point, whether that's, you know, 3 hours a day of TV or whether that's, you know, an extra 2000 calories at dinner or, you know, our sexual proclivities. Obviously those being the worst because, you know, we violated other people's, you know, personal space and that kind of stuff. To tackle this up front also, can you shed some light on, because if I walk out the door right now and I asked, you know, 10 Catholics on the street, they're going to tell me that the problem with the Catholic Church sexually is that priests were molesting children. And that's not really what the reporting found out. Is that correct?
Well, I thought you were going a different direction with your question, but I think, are you focusing on the question about whether they were children or not, or whether they were actually...
Yeah, I mean, to your point, I think that the homosexual nature of and not being celibate, period, whether you're heterosexual or homosexual, is the biggest issue. But I don't think that that's really the word that's been out on the street for the last, you know, 30 years.
Okay, well, so yeah, you raised a bunch of interesting topics, in what you were saying. First off, the first thing you had said, you were talking about the 1900 years of the church recognizing the importance of ascetical practice. I completely, yes, you're absolutely right about that. It has to do with our understanding of our fallen human nature and the need to transform that human nature. And what happened in the late 20th century, you might remember you're probably a young guy, but probably too young to remember this, but a book very popular in the 1970s was called I'm Okay, You're Okay. And the idea was it completely rejected the Christian understanding that we had a sinful nature that needed to be reordered and needed to be transformed. And one of the big ways that we do that, transforming our nature, is through ascetical self-denial. But if these social scientists were right that we didn't have a fallen nature, that everybody's okay just the way they are, then there's no need for asceticism.
Right.
And so no need for self-denial. So like you said, so why should I deny myself another 2,000 calories here or another beer or another movie, et cetera, et cetera? And so the point that you're raising there is actually the one that is behind my first book. My first book, I get into that. And you're absolutely right. There is a tremendous amount of research that actually confirms what the church taught about the values of asceticism. In fact, the neuroscientists have discovered inside the brain a system called the dopamine reward system, and it turns out that if you don't have that, if you don't keep that system in check, you become easily the victim of all kinds of addictions and so forth.
To
and
Twitter, or every time it chirps at me, I have to check it.
Yes, that's right. Exactly. Social media can be very addictive also. And so what they found out was, how do you keep the dopamine reward system in check? How do you avoid addiction? Ascetical practice turns out to be one of the best things for self-control. That is actually neuroscientific research. And so, in fact, current research is confirming what the church always taught, which is that asceticism is necessary. And so what happened in the 1970s when social scientists were claiming that self-denial was not necessary? Well, we became obese, actually. There's journalists have been writing for decades now about a tremendous obesity epidemic in the United States of America because there's no need to deny ourselves any longer. And so people there, what happened was the traditional understanding of our passions was that they're fallen and disordered. And so we get the idea of the seven deadly sins from that, right?
Right.
So there was a time when we thought of gluttony as a bad thing. Well, the word gluttony has sort of fallen out of use. Nobody talks about it anymore. And so as a result, you have an epidemic of people battling obesity because they haven't been taught the right way, which is the church's traditional way of self-denial. And so it impacted us. It impacted our culture in a lot of ways. The sexual abuse epidemic, yes, but also an epidemic of obesity, an epidemic of drug abuse, violence. There's so many things that have just went haywire when social scientists encouraged us to follow our passion. Yeah. Exactly the opposite advice of James chapter 4. So I would recommend your audience go back and read the letter of James. Read James chapter 1 and James chapter 4 and see what he says about the passion. And that's, we need to get back to that. We need to get back to the wisdom of the Bible, because science is actually proving James to be correct.
Yeah, that is a great recommendation. You know, the other thing kind of on that topic that you and Patrick had talked about on Patrick mm-hmm. Coffin's show, the phrase came up, guilt, and when I heard it, I was like, yeah, Catholic guilt. And you didn't say Catholic guilt, but I mean, that was the basis of the conversation. And again, so many people, you know, will use that phrase in a bad way. Isn't there some level of guilt that is healthy that we should have, as especially as Catholics, to say, you know, we are sinful and we are fallen, and we should have some level of guilt to the glory of God and His mercy and justice that He, you know, that He pours down upon us. I mean, isn't there some level of guilt that we should feel that is a healthy amount?
Absolutely, and shame also. I mean, these are not, you know, psychologists wanted to demonize every negative emotion that we have. Also, another one that's really unpopular now is hate, right? You can't, if you're a hater,
right?
You're a bad guy if you're a hater. But the truth is, where would we be without hate? Are we supposed to hate evil? Are we supposed to hate immorality? Are we supposed to hate injustice? I mean, the thing is, if you don't have hate, where would we be without it? You need to have hate to properly value the good things of life. And so you're right. All the negative emotions have been, are regarded suspiciously. But the fact is they hold us in. They keep us on the straight and narrow path, so to speak. It's too bad that more priests didn't experience shame and guilt when they were committing the horrible crimes they were committing, because I think that's one of the ideas. I think, the experience of these negative emotions is what can keep us out of jail.
Right.
I mean, maybe a person might need to make a little extra money, but that's no excuse to go lifting your friend's wallet off of his dresser when he's not looking or what have you, right?
Absolutely.
You know, so the thing is, we Yes, I would say I agree with you. Yeah, guilt and shame and these things and hatred of immorality and so forth. We need our negative emotions as much as we need our positive ones.
We're going to take a quick break while we talk with John Gravino. You're listening to Catholic Conversations on Catholic Spirit Radio 89.5.
You're listening to Catholic Conversations with Jason Bramley on Catholic Spirit Radio.
Join Catholic Spirit Radio in a prayer for vocations.
God our Father, you made each of us to use our gifts in the body of Christ. We ask that you inspire young men and women who you call to priesthood and consecrated life to courageously follow your will. Send workers into your great harvest so that the gospel is preached, the poor are served with love, the suffering are comforted, and your people are strengthened by the sacraments. We ask this through Christ our Lord. Amen.
Catholic Radio, changing hearts and minds.
Found your station about a month ago, and I have never turned my station off since I found you. Every time something I take offense to comes up, y'all answer it almost immediately as to make me see through with prayer. Thank you so much for saving me.
We depend on your support to keep Catholic Spirit Radio on the air 24 hours a day, broadcasting the truth and beauty of the Catholic Church.
We are back, Catholic Conversations with Jason Bramley on Catholic Spirit Radio 89.5. We are talking with John Gravino. So, again, going back to, you know, talking with kind of just the Catholics on the street, I hear a very steady drumbeat, it seems like. And obviously, it's coming from, you know, the hierarchy throughout the world and even the Vatican. And we're going into the Amazon Synod here. But this idea that, well, you know, we can just fix this, to your point, if we just allow priests to get married.
Right. The proof, the best argument against that is the fact that many Protestant churches are faced with the same sexual abuse crisis that we're experiencing. It's been in the news as well. There was a big, I think it was a few months ago, a huge I think it was a Houston newspaper that broke a story about a long-term crisis in the Baptist Church. And so the fact is those guys are allowed to get married, and it did not prevent them from getting involved with sexual abuse.
Right. So the problem is a morality problem.
It's a morality problem. It's a self-control problem. If you want to get rid of sexual abuse, then get rid of pornography. That would be a much more effective deterrent.
Right.
Remedy.
To your point.
Than allowing priests to get married.
Sure. So,
and the other thing is, look, the United States, the world has a tremendous problem with sexual abuse. Sexual trafficking is, according to the FBI, it's the fastest growing business of organized crime. Well, the perpetrators of this sexual abuse are not priests. You know, the vast majority of them are non-celibate people.
Yeah. Yeah,
so
to your point.
There's absolutely no way that you can pin the sexual abuse problem on celibacy, because the problem is much a much bigger problem with non-celibates than it is with celibate priests.
To your point, as the laity goes, obviously the vast majority of us are married, and we have rampant problems with either infidelity or pornography. It doesn't stop.
Point.
You know, just because it's a for the vast majority, I think of sexual deviant behavior, it really comes down typically to power and control more than anything. I think for most people, it's not about the gratification that they might receive from the act. It's about the power and the control that they receive or that they feel. To your point with the, you know, it's more about the dopamine and having the fulfilling that need to have some control over a chaotic world that, you know, we feel like we don't have control over. There's some small amount of thing that we can control, and it gives us power for some brief amount of time.
There are definitely famous cases of sexual abusers that I think fit the portrait that you're painting right here. Certainly people like Harvey Weinstein definitely, I think, fit that example that you're talking about. Ted McCarrick fits the that portrait that you're painting there also. But a lot of these guys, what they're finding, and this is I've attended a number of talks. One was by an FBI director who said that one characteristic that a lot of sexual abusers have is addiction. That is, that they're addicted to their crimes. They're addicted to sex in some way. And they're not only just addicted to the abuse that they have gotten involved in, but they're also addicted to pornography.
Yeah.
That's the reason why they find so much. You know, every time they arrest one of these guys, you see it on the news, they also find a huge cache of pornography on these people's computers and so forth. So, in fact, Jeffrey Epstein is another example that they found, you know, they got into his apartment or what have you. What did they find? They found all kinds of videos of, you know, his different victims and so forth. Lots of pornography is associated with this and addiction. Addiction has a lot to do with this.
I have a buddy who's a retired SWAT officer, and obviously completely anecdotal here, but you know, he mm-hmm. said when they would do raids on drug houses, it was always the same in the bedroom. The one nightstand would have like the Bible and a rosary and a statue of Mary, and the other nightstand would, you know, be full of pornography and
wow.
You know, it was always that, you know, to your point, as sinful, fallen beings, you know, we constantly wrestle with that. And when if we're told that we shouldn't have those guilty or shameful feelings, and we should embrace, you know, the dark side of human nature, then, you know, where do we think we're going to end up?
Right. That was the problem that social science gave us, because the apostles told us, the writers of sacred scripture told us to stay away from our dark passions, to stay away from our passions and to, you know, limit them and control them and allow your reason to control your passions. And the social scientists really were very naive. They were very naive about human nature. And so what they did in the process was they turned a lot of people that could have led very normal, healthy lives. They turned these people into addicts of various kinds, unfortunately. So I think it would be really, I think we're going to wise up, hopefully, very soon, and people will begin to appreciate the value of asceticism again. That really is the key, I think, to our getting healthier in terms of our culture and so forth.
Yeah, in the book, do you just kind of end it on a gloomy day, or is there a... Or is the last chapter kind of devoted to what things look like going forward and how, as individuals, you know, we can hopefully make things, at least in our personal lives, better? Or what are your thoughts there?
Yeah, the recent book is really confined
to the problem.
The sexual abuse scandal.
Okay.
And the first book is more theoretical and certainly... The first book does paint or offer a prescription for improvement. Yes, there's no doubt. There's definitely a way out. There's
Perfect.
Definitely a way forward.
So people just need to buy both books. That's the moral of the story here is that it's a two-part series.
Well,
you need both.
Sure, but if you don't want to buy, look, the truth is the moral of the story is that traditional Christianity is true.
Yeah.
And it is the traditional Christianity basically took a... sucker punch, if you will, from the social sciences in the 20th century. And the social scientists said, Bible thumpers don't understand human nature. We understand human nature. Well, actually, now that we're in the 21st century, neuroscience has come along and is vindicating our understanding of human nature that came from the Bible. And so we need to not take these social scientists so seriously and believe that our faith is outdated. It's not. It's being confirmed by neuroscience. And so we need to go back to our Bibles and read them. And that is the key to healing. That is what is going to solve. Let me tell you, that's what's going to solve a lot of the mental illness and a lot of the suicide problem that we're seeing in our culture.
School shootings also, I think.
What's that?
School shootings also, I think, have a deep root in that.
Oh, yes, because there's a lot of those kids, you know, were diagnosed with mental illnesses. So yes, I think the key is getting back to the Bible. And it's not a coincidence that we had a problem, an epidemic of school shootings when Christianity, at the same time that Christianity was unpopular. If you look at the Pew studies, the least Christian generation in the history of America is the millennial generation. That's the generation that gave us school shootings.
Yeah.
It's not a coincidence. Also, the millennial generation is the most mentally ill generation thus far. And there are lots of books and studies on this that have nothing to do with Christianity. These are studies that have no religious point of view whatsoever, just crunching the numbers. It's a... and this is a big, you know, I'm 54 years old. I've got kids who are part of that younger generation. These are my children that we're talking about. I care about them. I love them. I want what's best for them. I don't want to see them suffering, with depression needlessly if there's, a solution. And yeah. I think there is. The solution is traditional Christianity for a lot of problems. I'm not saying, of course, that it solves every problem, but there are physical bases for some problems. But what I'm saying is these epidemic rates that we're seeing of mental illness, it's not a coincidence that we're seeing those things at the same time that Christianity has been disappearing. And that's research that's coming from the Harvard School of Public Health. I'm going to hopefully put out an article about some of the research that they're doing on the link between positive mental health and religious devotion. It's a fascinating study that is being done right now that is really hard empirical evidence that one of the best things for mental health is our religion.
Yeah.
So
I want
for us to keep in mind.
I want to ask you, as a Catholic father, it's I have mm-hmm. five fairly young children. The awesome. Oldest is going to be 14 this month. I can't believe that in a year I'm going to have to deal with a driver's permit. It blows my mind. But yeah. I've spent as an insurance agent for my day job, I've spent a lot of time going and talking to older folks. Grandparents at this point who have mm-hmm. watched their children, that were probably, closer to your age that fell away from the church, through yeah. high school and college and early years and probably, you're probably unfortunately one of the lucky ones that had a reversion. A lot, unfortunately, have not yet. And so I know that those things bother them. And, so I want to ask what your thoughts are as a parent that we can do? What are some of the most important things that we can do? But before that, before we get to what maybe we can do about it, I also have the question in regards to where is the church's accountability for, I think in a lot of times turning away in some of the actions that they have, turning away those kids as they become, adults in college. I can think of specifically, recently it seems like, we have bishops and cardinals that can't come to a conclusion on what church doctrine is, we have the dubia that the Pope still hasn't answered. Where is the church's responsibility to the faithful to address these things, one, in a timely manner, but then also in an orthodox, faithful manner to the magisterium? I think that that's where a lot of kids get turned off. They say, well, these guys can't agree on any of this stuff, so how am I supposed to figure it out?
Yeah, well, okay, Jason, Yeah, that's a great question. You're right. We are right now in the middle of a unprecedented doctrinal crisis in the church. People now seem to agree that what's happening in the church right now is just really, this is a unique situation in the history of the church that we've never seen before. And so there is tremendous chaos, you're right, and a tremendous amount of disagreement about what the church actually teaches. Well, what I would say is, here's one thing that we can all agree on, and that is everybody agrees. For example, we can't We can't disagree about what the church traditionally taught. Everybody knows what the church traditionally taught.
Right.
Well, that, you know, my advice to parents is stick with that, because that is what scientists are actually studying right now. They're studying traditional religion, and they're finding all of these psychological health benefits associated with traditional religious spirituality. So that would be my advice to parents is don't give up on your traditional faith. Don't give up on your rosaries. Don't give up on your Eucharistic adoration. Don't give up on going to church. In fact, the Harvard study that I was talking to you about was specifically addressed to people who go to who attend Mass. And in the study that they did, they found that the people with the lowest suicide rate was recorded among Catholics who attended Mass more than once per week.
Wow.
Yeah, it wasn't those that call themselves spiritual but not religious. That wasn't the group with the best mental health.
Right.
It was the ones that were going to church and going to church often that had the best mental health, according to the Harvard School of Public Health. But the situation the church is in right now is, this is a very difficult, challenging time for the church, and we really don't know how this is going to turn out. It involves the Pope, and one of the big problems is people seem to not have an understanding of what do you do when the Pope is disagreeing with all the popes that came before him. I mean, this is really the problem that we're in right now. Like you said, Pope Francis has not answered the Dubia Cardinals. So why hasn't he? And
right.
What does one do? What does one do in this situation? We're in a unique circumstances right now, and you're right. One of the costs of this is probably going to be confusion among Catholics about whom should I believe?
Yeah.
Here's what the Pope says. Here's what this bishop says. This bishop says something different from this bishop. And what about the German bishops? What's going on in Germany right now? Right.
Right.
Everyone seems to have their own ideas about what is compatible with Catholic teaching and so forth.
And I think the one thing that I would say to folks that, I think one of the most common things, again, with maybe just kind of the commoner Catholic is, well, we used to think this, but times change and society changes, and so now we think this. And the one thing that I would say to those folks is that that's not really a viable theological argument. If we professed something to be objectively true, then the truth doesn't ever change. And so if 1,000 years ago the Catholic Church said that, homosexuality was mortally sinful, then that can't then change just because society wants it to change, or, the current Pope may or may not want it to change. Objective truth is and always is objectively true.
That's a very good point, Jason. And I think that what has fueled the argument for reform or endless reform has been the fact that some people point to Vatican II and say, see, well, a lot of things changed after Vatican II. Well, it is true. Some things can change. We certainly are, the church is allowed to change all different sorts of things, but there are some things that the church is not allowed to change. And so we have trusted our shepherds to know the difference between the things that can change and the things that can't change. And up till Pope Benedict, our popes have been very good and very reliable about respecting those boundaries. Some things can change, some things cannot change. But one of the things that cannot change is our morality. There's a reason why the Ten Commandments were put in stone. And that the fact that they were put in stone was to remind us that these are permanent. And that holds for today. And so the Sixth Commandment, which is the one governing sexual morality, holds for all time. And no one has the authority to set that one aside. So, the condemnation of homosexuality, the condemnation of sex outside of marriage is still valid today as it was thousands of years ago when Moses brought the Ten Commandments down from the mountain.
Yeah.
So that and we have Pope John Paul II to remind us of that in Veritatis Splendor. So if anyone wants to know, well, you know, what's your proof that that cannot change? The proof is from the writings of John Paul II.
Yeah,
you can just send them over to Veritatis Splendor, and also the Catechism of the Catholic Church, which was written during John Paul's pontificate.
Yeah,
so those are good reminders of the permanence of our Christian morality.
Absolutely.
Our Christian morality is a biblical morality, and per the teaching of John Paul II in Veritatis Splendor, that teaching is for all time. It can never change. And it never will change, and no one has the authority to say differently, and that includes the present pope. He doesn't have the authority to proclaim all kinds of exceptions to the rules if those exceptions don't exist. So.
Absolutely. Well, John, I so appreciate you coming on with us. This conversation has probably triggered about 50 more questions, but I don't want to keep you all day, so we're going to wrap up, but hopefully we can have you back on soon. For folks that are listening, give us again the two books that you've written and where they can find them and your website and all that kind of stuff if they want to follow you.
Okay. My books, the first book is called The Immoral Landscape of the New Atheism. The second book on the abuse scandal is called Confronting the Pope of Suspicion. They're both available on Amazon. And I blog at... my website is called newwalden.org, and I also, from time to time, you can also find some of my articles at the stream as well.
Yeah, and you're on Twitter, right?
Oh, yeah. that's true also.
The firestorm that is Catholic Twitter these days.
Yeah, oh boy, isn't that the truth?
Oh, man, we've had some other Catholic Twitter folks on. It amazes me, you know, to your point about the chaos in the church, it just amazes me. You know, that we can't band together. We should have a very unified set of core tenets and beliefs and to your point, morals that hold us all together. And unfortunately, because of all the chaos and things, in and out of the church for the last 30 or 40 years or 50 years, however long it's been, and Twitter just exacerbates that. So if you're a good Catholic and you're not on Twitter, just don't do it.
I feel like I got to put on a helmet and all my military gear before I sign on to my Twitter account. It is a battle right now.
It is a battle, but we're battling for souls every day, so I guess we should keep up the good fight.
Excellent. Yes. Thanks, Jason, for having me on your show.
Absolutely, John. I so appreciate it. You're listening to Catholic Conversations with Jason Bramley and John Gravino, our guest today. Again, thank you for coming. If you missed it or if you're just tuning in, go back and listen to our podcast on Apple, iTunes, or on Podbean. Or as always, you can download the Catholic Spirit Radio app and listen to it also. I hope everybody has a blessed weekend, and we will see you again next week.
You've been listening to Catholic Conversations with Jason Bramley on Catholic Spirit Radio 89.5 and 92.5. Brought to you by the generous support of Meyer Bramley Insurance, serving Illinois, Missouri, and Kansas. Meyer Bramley Insurance can be reached online at mbi.agency or via phone at 844-890-2626. Catholic Conversations, where we talk about faith, family, and finance. Download our podcasts at CatholicSpiritRadio.com.
Can I ask you a question? Are you encountering adversity in your life? Are you carrying a heavy cross? Is your cross a serious illness? A broken relationship? The loss of a loved one? Financial, mental, emotional, physical, spiritual? Yes, crosses come in many forms, and crosses are difficult. They can be very heavy. They can be overwhelming. Is your cross crushing you? Do you feel at times like you cannot even breathe? Well, I know a little bit about the cross, and I want to assure you that Our Lord Jesus is with you and he knows everything about your cross. As a matter of fact, he went before you when he hung and bled and died on the cross for you. Well, the world is being redeemed through the cross. As difficult and painful as our crosses may be, it is a great privilege to be given the gift of the cross in our lives. Listen, there is one thing we will not have in heaven, and that if it's possible to have nostalgia in heaven, we will have nostalgia for this, and that is the redemptive and purifying crosses we were blessed with during our lives. Yes, the cross is literally joined to God. Jesus, God and man, allowed himself to be nailed to the cross. And if we want to be one with Jesus here on earth, we need to allow him to pull us up on the cross with him. Because in a real sense, that is where he is at, and that is where we will find him. We can only really see the world for what it is through the view from up on the cross. It is there that we learn to love everything and everyone from the cross, because God is love and he is one with the cross. Yes, Jesus died once, rose, and is seated at the right hand of the Father in heaven, but he is mystically still on the cross, redeeming the world through his mystical body, the church, and that is you, and that is me. And don't forget that the cross leads to the resurrection. I'm Jim Littleton, FormingFaithfulFamilies.com.
Welcome to Spirit of Stewardship. Jeremy Belsky is your host for real-life stories, encouragement, and ideas to enhance your own gifts of work, wealth, and wisdom in response to God's blessings for you.
I'm Jeremy Belsky, and today's topic is From Selfish to Unselfish, Sharing Time with Others. When the topic of stewardship is mentioned, we understand that it's our Christian responsibility to share our resources with others. What some might not fully comprehend is the importance of sharing our time with others or causes near and dear to our heart. With whom do you enjoy sharing time? Have you given thought as to how you might be more generous with your time? I know a young man who volunteered his time at a retirement home. He assisted a 93-year-old lady by writing letters to her family members. Initially, this might not seem so important until you know that the woman dictating the letters is blind. Writing had been one of her life passions, and to be able to continue doing this with the help of the young man brought uplifting spirits for each of them. You have heard the phrase, time is money. This is one reason why it's difficult for some people to volunteer. It forces the volunteer to be unselfish. However, being forced to do something rarely brings with it any genuineness either. Surely there must be at least one area in your life that compels you to make a difference toward humankind. If not, spend some time in prayer. For this is perhaps the best time we can give back to God, to praise and glorify, to thank, and request his favor. Finally, the book of Hebrews reminds us to be unselfish when it states in chapter 13, verse 16, "Do not neglect to do good and to share what you have. God is pleased by sacrifices of that kind." I'm Jeremy Belsky, your host for Spirit of Stewardship.
To learn how you can better share your talents and resources, contact your local parish priest. Your level of involvement in the church now positively impacts our faith in the future.